Good afternoon. Good to see everybody. Welcome to the Worship Wars. My name is Len Berglund, and I'm serving the village this week in capacity of assisting the village musicians. Part of what I do is music performance, but part of what I do also is non-performance oriented, that is talking about church music issues in general. I am a church musician, have spent the majority of my career working for several different churches and several different denominations, but I also make a living singing. There is such a thing as being a professional chorister, and singing in choirs for a living. I started out with Roger Wagner and the old Roger Wagner Chorale, and that became the Los Angeles Master Chorale. It's still the only professional ensemble in the country that has its own season as well as a full season as the symphonic chorus with the LA Philharmonic. So it's a very busy ensemble. We sing constantly. It can be everything from cartoon voices to opera work to choral orchestral work to recordings. It's what makes it fun. So I come from a couple of different perspectives. The Worship Wars. How many are in Lutheran churches? Everybody. Oh. Any? Okay, all right. How many come from a Methodist background? Nope. Presbyterian? No, none. Catholic?
Methodist Presbyterian.
Methodist Presbyterian, okay. Catholic, okay. Episcopal? Other?
UCC,
okay. I spent 10 years working with First Friends Church in Whittier. It's a Quaker, large Quaker church. There are some similarities and some differences. Every single one of them, every single denomination, every single non-denominational church also ends up fighting these same worship wars. And what I mean by the worship wars is there are two movements of worship going on right now. There's the historical, traditional, and then there's contemporary worship. And the contemporary crowd and the traditional crowd, when they talk to each other, often just buck heads. And that's all we do, is just, there's the line. I don't like drums. I don't like the guitars. I don't like the basses. I only want organ music, or I only want the choir or the piano. And rather than talk to each other about how things can be combined or how things can complement each other, we just draw the line in the sand and go from there. Actually go nowhere from there. So I kind of want to start by defining a little bit more of what we're up against. Somebody give me a style of music, any style of music.
Jazz.
Bravo.
What else?
Classical.
Classical.
Gregorian chant.
That's good. Chant is going to come under this category. And we're going to have, we can have Gregorian chant, we can have Ambrosian chant, we can have Byzantine chant. They're all great. More.
Rock.
Folk. Bluegrass.
New Age.
Good, New Age.
Hip hop.
Good.
Western swing.
Good.
Gospel.
Ah, good. Gospel. All right.
Death metal.
I'm going to misspell that.
Death.
D-E-F?
No.
Death, as in death.
As in dead.
As in live.
T-H.
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 Death.
Like eagles of death metal.
All right. Like that? Yeah.
Like that.
Okay. All right. More.
A million different actors.
Early music.
I'm sorry, what?
Early music.
Early music. Medieval? Renaissance?
Medieval.
They have, there are Dixieland masses, there can be polka masses. Or country. World music.
Conjunto.
I'm sorry, what?
Conjunto.
Spell.
Conjunto. If you go to San Antonio, Texas, you'll hear it in Catholic masses.
Okay.
Opera.
The movies, before there were movies. So where?
Vaudeville, is that a kind of music?
Tin Pan Alley, maybe. Vaudeville is more of I don't know if there's a particular music that's associated with that, other than maybe Tin Pan. Yep.
This lady said ethnic too many dimensions.
I'm sorry, ethnic too many.
That goes under world music.
That goes under world music, ethnomusicology.
Or praise music.
Praise. Oh, I'm going to add a few here because we need some grunge.
Reggae.
Probably also comes under world music. More.
Musical theater.
Good.
Contemporary choir.
Contemporary
choral music. Choral.
What kind of contemporary?
Aleatory.
A lot of people would call this experimental. Remember the old film Stanley Kubrick, 2001, Space Odyssey, and you had some really weird-sounding choral music. That's the score of the Ligeti Requiem. It's a blast to sing. Difficult to listen to. But in context of that music, or in context of that movie, highly successful. It does what it's supposed to do. It transports us to another time and place. More.
Chamber music.
Chamber, good.
Baroque.
Romantic. Early 20th century. Late 20th century. 21st century.
Holden music.
I'm sorry, what?
Holden music.
Holden music. Holden music is very eclectic, but we're going to put it up there anyway.
Atonal.
Yeah, there you go. Atonal. Schoenberg gets a bad rap. Anybody ever, yes, he wrote some of the bleep, squeak, splat kind of orchestral music, but he also wrote The Girl Eater. And The Girl Eater is one of those pieces we put it on, and that is as romantic as they come. And it's enormous in size. And once he finished it, there was really nothing else to do other than we need to create a different language. So he ends up with 12-tone. But he starts out, Schoenberg starts out as a true romantic in the Strauss Mahler vein and kind of ends up in a different universe at the end. Okay, well, we can see what kind of music is possible and out there. We still don't have
spirituals up there.
Spirituals. Well, that's going to be more gospel, maybe.
Hymns.
Hymns. That's kind of too general.
Motet.
Yeah, motet. That's going to be Renaissance.
Chorales.
Chorale. Again, chorales from all eras. We need some
pop.
What?
Pop.
Commercial pop.
Yeah.
Elevator.
Ah.
What was that?
Elevator music.
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 Computer music.
What was this going to be?
Commercial
pop.
What does that mean, Celine Dion?
That's a big category. Okay. Now that we've got all of these, and we can add more as they come to us. So here's the monkey wrench. Which one of these, or how many of these, or which ones are appropriate for worship?
Whatever Martin Luther wrote.
I'm glad you brought him up. Anybody want to know? We all think of Martin Luther as being quite revolutionary, obviously the Reformation. But other than A Mighty Fortress, what other Martin Luther hymns do we know?
The Way of the Wandering Is.
Yeah.
Lord, keep us steadfast.
Yeah.
Oh, Christmas Tree? I think he did the lyrics in German.
I mean, once we get beyond just a few hymns, Martin Luther kind of goes, wait a minute, are there more? And there are more, but not as many as we might think. There's maybe 35 that he had a hand in, either writing a text or a tune. But that doesn't seem quite the body of hymn repertoire that we might think. But look at Papa Bach, J.S. Bach, and how many chorales. Now, some of those chorales are Bach's, and some are other people's that Bach just chose to harmonize so skillfully that they have become associated with him. But Luther is important, but maybe for a different reason.
I was kidding, actually.
Which one of these is probably, which ones are probably, we wouldn't hear in church?
Chant, classical.
Hip-hop.
Hip-hop?
Or not in church.
What was the question?
Grunge.
Which ones of these probably would we not hear in worship? What we're after is which ones of these are appropriate for worship and which ones aren't appropriate.
Yeah. I think you could say they're all appropriate for worship, depending on how the audience is environment. Right. In our particular church, I mean, it's not going to be hip-hop. It's not going to be atonal. It's not going to be grunge. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the classical Baroque, the Renaissance, some spiritual and gospel.
Some jazz.
Some jazz, only if Jim gets his way once in a while. You know, we can call it pretty traditional. It's pretty traditional choral stuff that we do.
There's actually a fair amount of world music in the hymnal now. Music that gets worked in, or could get worked in the service.
Right.
What about?
Not much.
No,
not a lot. But would it, if it existed, and if it was performable?
Well,
could it be appropriate?
The church I grew up had a choir director who was a college professor, writer, and they sang some things that were maybe not quite atonal yet, but at the time were quite dissonant and quite, had people kind of looking around. But so you could sure Why couldn't you sing that as a hymn?
Sure. Igor Stravinsky wrote a Lord's Prayer that is entirely atonal. It's a blast to sing. It's difficult to sing. So it's not going to be something that's done by...
Plus, things that were considered dissonant 40 years ago are not considered dissonant anymore.
Correct.
Atonal is going to go that way as well. I'm not pretty sure.
That's correct.
You know, as you get used to things, you evolve.
Good. That's a great observation. Do you know why? What's happening in current culture that's helping to break those bounds?
More diversity.
Diversity.
Yeah.
Communication.
Where do we hear a lot of the brand new things for the first time? The movies. That's where we heard the Ligeti Requiem for the first time.
You don't find more people listening to it.
No, but people that say I hate Schoenberg and Stravinsky and some of the Webern and Alban Berg, they would say, "Oh, I don't like that music." But if you listen to a film that depicts the Holocaust, it might be musically exactly what you need to underpin the story. So our movies help us to break some of our preconceived attitudes about what music we want to sit and listen to. Plus, we get them in little doses. A scene is 3-4 minutes. We can sit through almost 3 or 4 minutes of anything. Anybody that's taught elementary school knows that. You've just got tons and tons of noise and the enthusiasm that goes along with it. Your observation is the one that I like to adopt, and most churches have not adopted. All of these styles in some form can and have been used in worship. And very meaningfully, not just on the fringe, but very meaningfully. But it depends on what you brought up. It depends on context. If we come up and do hip-hop in North Dakota, it might not fly. But if we do a hip-hop mass in South Central LA, you're going to fill the church. And you're going to fill the church with kids. You won't fill them with all the kids, because hip-hop is going to speak to a certain demographic. Same, New Age is going to speak to a certain age group. Bluegrass is going to speak to a different part of ourselves and our country than in others. It depends on what is relevant to the community. So that's kind of the setup. This is what we're faced with. So I'm going to erase of these. And how many of your churches have what they call a contemporary service? Contemporary service, do you use guitars? Do you use something other than a piano or an organ? Some churches will hold two services. The first service is maybe a traditional. The second service is a contemporary. Most Christian pop music falls under the category of, let's see, easy listening, soft rock. Not all of it falls into that category, but a large amount of it falls into this category. Anything with guitars, a lot of commercial music, a lot of Christian pop stations kind of play this. it's not quite elevator music, but it's not Black Sabbath either. It's kind of in between, and sometimes it speaks to us, sometimes it doesn't. But it kind of all can get put into a broad category here. Anybody want to know when this started? Anybody want to hazard a guess of when the style started?
In the 60s?
A little later.
Okay. I would say 25 years ago or so.
Probably more. Anybody remember, if you're my age or older, anybody remember a group called the Carpenters? Yes. Karen and Richard Carpenter. Yeah, that's probably the most recognizable style of easy listening soft rock. And that has become the model for most contemporary Christian music that's used in contemporary worship. Now, I'm not talking about what's used specifically in a Lutheran church or a Methodist church or a Presbyterian church. This is just a broad wash. The Carpenters. '73? So we're talking about a style of music that's now 45 years old, even a little older. Are we still talking contemporary? Not according to our kids. That's old fart music. Sorry. But that's what I get called by our kids. And that's old fuddy-duddy music. But that's what we're calling contemporary music, contemporary Christian music. And when we come up, we have people that absolutely love this, absolutely respond to it, congregations that love it and respond to it, and that's the predominant style. And then we have the traditional, which is largely dominated by those forms that fall under the classical music category. Medieval, Renaissance, classical, romantic, early 20th century. Some people consider this art music. And this is more considered pop. And here's the dividing line. So there are the worship wars. So, what kind of musician looks and plays well in either side?
Piano.
Well, most people that study the piano on this side, do they cross over? They can.
Sure.
Yeah.
Keyboards.
Do they? Some do. Some don't. On this side, you've got guitars. You've got some drums. You've got some percussion. Maybe you have a synthesizer. You have some other things. Do they cross over? They can in the same way. Yeah. They can cross over in the same way, but do they?
No.
Not as much. When we train young musicians in the colleges and the universities, I'm a product of USC. I went through all my undergraduate work and in music, and I learned how to sing. I had background in strings and brasses and orchestration and everything else. We had no classes in church music. It's not part of the curriculum. It isn't there. Now, in church-oriented schools, Cal Lutheran, Whittier College for Quakers, they will have an occasional elective class in music of their denomination. But it's a class or two. So our church musicians, those who will be going out into the field, get very, very little training at the time that they graduate in church music, in any kind of church music. So now we come out, now we've got the further puzzle. We as a church, we've hired a new church musician. And maybe it's a liturgical church, maybe it's a Lutheran church. And we think that this is the good person, the right person to come in. And we turn them loose and let them work, and all of a sudden we're getting hymns or we're getting choir anthems that have absolutely nothing to do with the season of the church year. And we're puzzled. Why? Why are we doing this piece now? It's not Lent. Or why are we doing this now? This is Easter. We're in December. Why are we doing this? They don't know. We're not training them to do that. By the time they get into graduate school, then they begin to get some specific training that is actually useful for churches. So there's another big disconnect. We put these two together, and we've got a poor music director here who's in that church situation now, and they're doing the best they can. And they pick out a piece of music, and it's just not the right piece of music. Congratulations, they've just stepped in a landmine. They're going to hear about it. Welcome to the Worship Wars. Okay, that's how the Worship Wars start. So, anybody had that experience in your churches?
I'm just wondering about the instrumentation. The organ plays such a key role with traditional classical music. I'm in a situation right now where we're putting $125,000 to restore an organ in our mm-hmm. church. Why are we doing that?
Without defending either side, because I do have an opinion, and my own personal opinion is bravo, thank you, keep doing it.
That's fine as long as we have someone to play it.
There's that. That is the sticky question. Where are the organists coming from? More and more college and universities are removing their organ departments from their music. And those some schools that have had huge organ departments before, USC is one of them. USC has two full-time, full professors who do nothing but teach organ performance. And their classes over the years have gone down, 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 down. And these are brilliant performing musicians and teachers. What's happening? Money. If I'm a musician and I go through 4 years of undergraduate, I go through 2 or 3 years of a master's degree, and I go through 4 to 5 years of a doctorate so I can play the instrument's repertoire and I can play it skillfully, well, in any denomination, in any situation, I want to know that I can actually make a living doing that. How many churches, or how many of you have churches that have a full-time organist? A few might.
You mean you have other jobs too?
I'm sorry, what?
Paying enough to be considered a full-time.
Paying enough to be considered a full-time position, which is a full-time salary plus benefits. 3/4 plus benefits. Some will get half. Some will get, oh, they only work 10 hours a week. We're only going to pay them 10 hours a week. They might only see them 10 hours a week, but they didn't see the 30 hours that it took to prepare for the 10.
I'm getting a little confused. Are we talking about very large churches? Give you an example. We previously attended a church that was very well, did very, very well. They had an incredible musician that directed the choir, played the organ, did the piano, and he was full time, but he did everything. And so we had a full time, I guess you could call, and he was a brilliant organist, but he did everything. And I can't imagine that was a fairly well-to-do church. And I can't imagine a church that's, except a huge church, that would have enough money to have a full-time organist as well as a full-time choir director as well as, I mean, it seems to me if you're going to have that, you're talking about a very, very big church.
Yes and no, but you're correct. I was at a church in Pacific Palisades, California, and I would call it a moderately sized church, 400. They did have two services, but 400. This was an obscenely wealthy congregation, and there were just 400. They probably spent more in their music program than a church five times the size. It kind of depends on the socioeconomic community that the church is located in. But yes, a full-time job. You've got to pay a reasonable salary. And many organists go through that course of study to become competent at what they do, and they can't get employed. There just aren't enough churches and that will pay them a salary where they can even pay back their student loans, much less rent an apartment in L.A. That's a problem. It's a problem for choir directors who go to school, and now it's a church paying two positions. Maybe only one of them is full-time. If it's only one of them that's full-time, it's the organ that's full-time, because that's seen as the more difficult skill. I see it as somebody that has directed choirs. I see it as it's not what I do isn't easier than what they do. It's just different than what they do. But where would I go? I've gone through the same amount of schooling. I've gone through the same amount of study. I've prepared myself as a professional. Where do I go to be employed? So that's what's happening with church music programs and specifically organ programs. We're not paying enough. Because colleges and universities are downsizing their organ programs, churches are left with, well, we've got to find somebody that can play at least the piano. So now you've got a keyboard player in there. Maybe they play the piano, maybe they can play the synthesizer. But hey, we've got a pipe organ here and we can't use it because they don't know how to play it. Or they're very advanced on the keyboard, but nobody has taught them pedals. So they're advanced in the hands and they're beginners with the feet. So we get some preludes and postludes that are Susie Leftfoot. Not always conducive to creative worship. It can be, yeah.
Don't you think, though, that just in the arts in general, unless you're in that top-tier performer, people in the arts always have a day job to support, you know, whatever they're doing. There aren't that many jobs available, full-time
teaching music
jobs.
After
teaching music in schools. So churches then, instead of becoming full-time positions, churches become part-time.
Well, because our organist fills all the needs. We have four services. We have one organist for Saturday night and one for the three, and then the Sunday morning organist is also the accompanist for the choir. So there's one rehearsal during the week. So all the needs are being met, but we don't really have the need for, you know, a 40-hour week person working on the music program, because you have several people, including one of the assistant ministers, contributing to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a pretty normal model for a lot of churches.
It is.
Yeah, we're a large church. We're 3,000 members.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I would agree with you. This is an offside, but talking about employing professional musicians, does anybody want to hazard a guess of who the largest full-time employer, who is the largest employer of full-time musicians?
Military.
Schools?
Yeah. U.S. military. Anybody want to hazard a guess of how many we pay full-time? It's an important area. I'm not being critical of the government or of music here. But the U.S. military, the U.S. federal government is the largest employer of full-time musicians. $6,000+. Each service organization has multiple bands. They have multiple choruses. They do wonderful PR work. They are service personnel who are the Marines. These are all riflemen. They all have their military service. They can be called at any time. But they also supply the personnel for the bands. And they are great players, and they are great singers. But it's not the L.A. Phil, it's not the New York Phil, it's not the Boston, it's not Houston, it's not Seattle. It's the U.S. federal government that knows the importance and the value of music. And I use that as my lobby when the NEA gets cut. Oh, we can't fund the NEA anymore because somebody might be offended. Well, come on, folks. We fund the military bands, and everybody loves the Marine Corps band when it marches in the Rose Parade. They are impressive. And they are first-rate musicians. So the military does, the government does know the value of music. We need to lobby harder. Yeah?
Going back to your earlier division, were you arguing that there's a shift towards the contemporary, towards the classic, the rock music, because there's a short, it's hard to find organists?
No.
Or are you finding the other way around, because there's not, the churches aren't demanding the organists?
Churches are not demanding the organist, but there's also some other things that are going on. Congregations are shifting, and because each of those styles of music only speaks to certain parts of a demographic of a congregation. What I might like, my son might just say, I'm not going anywhere near that. So we offer multiple kinds of services.
You know, one of the things I've noticed in recent years is that most of the weddings that I have, the request now is for piano as opposed to organ. And it's because it's the kind of music that they're hearing and they're used to hearing.
Right. The iPod is a revolution not only in technology, but it's going to be driving a lot of that. It's what they hear. A lot of people will gravitate towards that contemporary Christian pop because that's what's in their background. They've not been exposed. We're not teaching kids music anymore. It's a sad fact, but my own state that I have to claim, California, we have eliminated music in the public schools. And we have eliminated music in most of the private schools except those private schools that commit themselves to funding their own programs internally. And the reason that we've eliminated music from all schools in California, it's not on the test.
Oh.
Music isn't on the test. So why should we spend the time to teach it? And the teachers, the teachers that are there know that if you want reading scores to rise, you want math scores to rise, teach music. Not necessarily to get them all to be performers, but it teaches the brain a different kind of organization. So those people that have studied violin for even a semester are able to concentrate longer on a non-related music task. They're able to focus a little bit more than 3 minutes, which is the length of a pop song.
They've eliminated all?
I can't believe it.
Well, those public schools that do continue to have a music program, it's not because the Board of Education has said we need music in the schools. It's because the school has said we will commit whatever extra money that we have to funding this part of the program. But with that funding, dwindles and leaves, that's where we are now. There are schools that have wonderful music programs, and they funded it by themselves. The money is no longer there.
There's something else that's fundamentally different. I think the question is, what's the role of music in the service? And I've been to both kinds, Calvary Chapel being one and others. And at least my observation is, in the traditional service, the music is part of the liturgy. What I see in a lot of contemporary services is most of the liturgy is gone, and it's mostly music. And you have a sermon, you have no forgiveness of sins, any of that stuff, no communion in any traditional sense. Most of the liturgy disappears, and it's all music. So then the question is, what's the role of music in the service?
Absolutely.
And I'm not sure what that is, but just from being in some contemporary services, it seems like that is the service.
Yep.
Outside of a sermon performance.
I would agree. How many of your churches have had either a discussion or, as a music staff, have a philosophy of music that is published somewhere, or even talked about, particularly those churches that have a contemporary service and a traditional service? Do the churches have some kind of dialogue that goes on between those two different groups?
Yes, we have a church.
Good, good. I would say your church is to be commended. It's also a rarity. Because in most churches, the contemporary people do not talk to the traditional people. The traditional people wouldn't go anywhere near the contemporary people. They just sit and spit at each other back and forth. Hear that sucking sound over there? That's your pop group sucking my budget. And, you know, the traditional group is over here saying, well, if you guys weren't moldy, you know, maybe we'd bring some more people in. And that's...
Isn't it possible, too, that the contemporary people have already left the congregation? I mean, our churches, we're very traditional, we're very liturgical. We always have been. And that's the commitment from the pastoral staff. And I don't hear people saying, I wish we had a contemporary service. Maybe there are some, but very few. I think they probably already left and bought something else. And the ones who are there, the 2,000 are still there, seem very happy with the very traditional liturgical service. Mm-hmm.
But there's a rich... In this particular congregation, there's a rich musical tradition that includes diversity in musical approaches within a liturgical structure, as well as a very rich musical program of concerts and pulling the community in and all sorts of things. So
that's a rare church.
And are those concerts all classical?
No.
Oriented?
No.
Okay.
Musical theater,
military band,
all kinds of
yeah. That's a rare church, and boy, do I want that program. Why did churches gravitate towards contemporary worship styles to begin with?
Kids.
They want youth. They want family age. Young adults. Whoops. That's the target. That's the demographic that everybody, and there's not a denomination around that's not interested in having youth and family age young adults, because that seems to be our benchmark of whether we are a successful church or not. Mm-hmm. We might be 600 seniors and strong and have a going program, but unless we have youth in the church, we're less than that church of 150, but most of them are young kids. What happens also when we add some other dynamics to it, of all of our generations that are represented in church demographics, who are the more likely heavy donors? 50 to 75. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's not the youth and the family age young adults. They've got other financial priorities. They've got to get kids raised. And I don't disagree with that. We did that. We raised kids. We know what it costs. That's a huge commitment. but we're taking this and giving this demographic a huge amount of power to alter what kinds of worship services that we're having. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that that's just one of the issues that's out there, yeah.
If you, and this was one church that I was in. Another factor is if you have a contemporary service and you have a family that's looking for a church but isn't necessarily Lutheran, the Lutheran liturgy isn't, let's say, simple to get through if you've never done it before. A contemporary service, you can walk in, you can feel a part of it, there's lots of music, there's a message, and that's it. So it's easy to come in and be a part of that. So it's a great way to bring in people who aren't of your particular faith but might be looking for church home.
Absolutely. And I would also go a little bit farther and say, for the Lutheran churches that have a strong liturgical tradition, we're losing that.
Yeah.
We're losing. Why do we do a Kyrie? Well, what is it, first of all? Much less, why do we do it? What's a Gloria? What's a Credo? What's a Sanctus Benedictus? What's an Agnus Dei? Do we even need it? We can expect more, and that's neither good nor bad, it just is. But having grown up in the liturgical tradition, having studied the liturgical tradition, it's so rich. I would hate to lose.
Yeah.
I would hate to lose that.
Well, and then the best part about it is that this is the tradition that I grew up with, that my parents grew up with, that my grandparents grew up with, and I like the feeling that the church has continued that way for really hundreds of years. And
absolutely.
I'm part of that tradition. I don't want to leave.
And liturgies change. We would not be comfortable with the liturgy of the time of J.S. Bach. We would not want to be in church 4 hours. It would just, I'm sorry, but my rear end can't take it that long. It's not practical. So, yes, churches have changed and have altered, but you're right, there's a certain organization and structure that I like as well. But I also have to recognize that our kids, they don't have that same tie. They're not there yet.
I go to a church in the Boston area that has a very, it's probably a campus ministry, has a large young adult population. And there's actually a lot of young people who, I mean, this may not be typical, but there's a lot of young people who are looking for some of that tie to the what they grew up with, the more traditional. You know, and we do very little of the actual, the soft rock type music, but, you know, within the liturgy, the Lutheran liturgy, we do have a pretty substantial diversity. We'll do Taizé chants and, you know, Hispanic music and I think, you know, the young people appreciate having that sort of, it's not all just, you know, nostalgia or hymns. But we sing the old favorites as well as, you know, doing a lot of new, world.
Yeah, we can't do old
Margaret. I'm gonna use that stodgy old hymns. I'm doing later in the week a hymnology.
Yeah.
A hymnology session, but yeah, yeah.
So my point is, there still is some desire for having some of that tradition.
I think it's important, not only just in the Lutheran Church, but. The liturgical churches, Catholic, Episcopal, Lutheran being the three dominant ones, and they're all different. The Lutherans, thankfully, are more congregationally oriented in terms of their worship participation. We sing hymns. The Catholics are so jealous of what happens in what I would call a standard Lutheran liturgy. When a hymn comes around, by and large, congregations will stand and sing. In the Catholic Church, which also has a long tradition of hymnody, the congregation stands, the choir sings, and the congregation stares. There's no noise. There's no noise.
I once tried to do a Christmas hymn sing-along with a bunch of Catholics. It didn't go very well.
Yeah, yeah. There's quite a famous book called Why Catholics Can't Sing. But there's a historic tradition of why that has happened. Historically, in the Catholic Church, the singers have been trained. The choirs are trained. And the congregation are spectators. You are there to watch the priests. You are there to listen to the choir. You're there to just kind of take your place and sit there and watch. The whole revolution to have people involved with the services in the Catholic Church is relatively new. Like 1963, to have a non-priest read scripture, that's relatively new in comparison to the entire history of the Catholic Church. The Episcopalians have a different kind of an issue. Their services are just as complicated liturgically as ours. And they seem to be much more focused in, are they doing it correctly? It's a little bit like the French, you know, the old joke, it doesn't matter what you say, it only matters if you pronounce it correctly. It's the same in the Episcopal Church. It doesn't really matter what you do, it only matters if you do it in the right order and use the right words. The Lutheran Church, I think, has taken a much more practical and congregational approach. Encourage your congregations to sing, because we're losing that tradition. We don't teach singing in elementary schools anymore. In the public venue, it's the most popular or the only time that people sing as a group that's non-church.
National anthem.
The Star Spangled Banner and Take Me Out to the Ball Game. In order. And I would say of the two, at least in Los Angeles, it's Take Me Out to the Ball Game because nobody arrives in time. But that is corporate singing. We don't teach it anymore. So where is this? This is my commercial, because I'm also need to be over on the other side to work with the choir. So if you're interested, part of the teaser that was on the kiosk was, is there a roadmap for the way that we can talk to each other? And yes, there is. Very quickly, maybe we can do this. I'll dash over just in time. Talking about churches that have a philosophy or at least an open discussion about juxtaposing the two different styles. Are there statements that we can make that are true to both sides? I'm of the belief that we need to be as eclectic as possible. We need bluegrass masses. We need Christian pop. We need chant. We need chorales. We need our ethnic contributions. We need it all together, but we also need something, some kinds of statements that unify the whole process. So, we've got rules of engagement. And there is a wonderful source if you'd like to spend a little bit more time. It's a great title. And he's a wonderful writer and researcher. It's got... We could spend an entire year. I'd like to get it into the Holden bookstore. Seems like a simple statement, but it's got, again, we could take each of these and tear them apart. Do you want me to read those, or this is the one that gives congregations a lot of trouble. The fact that it might or might not be appropriate is less important than do I like it? Yeah. Or was it Aunt Susie's favorite? Or, but I want this piece for my wedding. Well, it's not a worship piece. It's kind of Friday night after the football games kind of piece. This is what happens when we get introduced to music that we're not used to. Wait a minute, what are we doing? Oh, we've got a gear shift here, and I don't think I'm ready for it. Is this church? and I've had grandparents in church that they don't like the new songs because they're not church. This is one for committees that do hiring of staff people. It takes a long time to become competent in styles of music that are as diverse as we want to use. And the issue that underpins that are we paying them for those skills? In some instances, we are, and in other instances, maybe we can't, or in some instances, we don't, even if we could. I like this one, because not every piece of music is going to speak to me. Or is going to speak to everyone, but hopefully within the context of a yearly cycle, we can do music that's relevant to every generation within our church community. But do we? Do we do music that's relevant to a 3- and 4-year-old? Do we do music that's relevant to our 80s and 90s seniors? Do we do music that's relevant to our teenagers? Sometime during the year, I would like to see where we have addressed each of those demographics multiple times. But we don't always do it. Where do we leave the conversation? Do we leave it with just finger pointing and then walk away? Or do we pick it up maybe at a later time when cooler heads can prevail and actually come to even an agreement that we're going to disagree? Just because we hear something once doesn't mean that we're going to learn everything about it. We need to hear it multiple times. We need to be exposed to chant more than just once in a blue moon, or hip-hop more than just a special Sunday when we've got a traveling band coming in, or maybe there's a youth event that it's appropriate. We need to be eclectic all the time. Again, this is addressing multiple demographics within every congregation. This is one of my favorites, particularly the last part. How do we move people away from come to Jesus in whole notes? To just the what we might consider to be very superficial music into something that's got, and there's a place for it, but do they ever move away from it, or do we spend the next 30 years just rehashing the same message? And this is one of the things that this is. These next series of slides are going to speak more towards music directors, organist directors. There's a little bit of practical kinds of questions here. I had a professor who would play a Mozart Ave Verum, and a wonderful, gorgeous choral piece unaccompanied. And then ask the class to raise their hands and say, how many people recognize that this is a great piece of music? And of course, the whole class shoots their hands up. And then he puts in the caveat, for a Baptist church. And everybody goes, ooh, and the hands go down. It's not relevant there. It's not part of their theology. It's not part of their tradition. So again, we have to ask that question. Are we using it? Why are we using it? Does it speak to the community? Are we doing it just because it's in the library and I don't have the budget this year? Is it still appropriate? Again, that goes part of the cycle of touching each generation in the congregation. And again, not every style is going to speak equally to every part of the demographic. Anybody ever sing the Orff Carmina Burana?
I know it well.
It's fun once or twice. After the fifth, sixth, seventh, half a dozen time, I've probably done it 40 or 50 times. Boy, I don't look forward to those sets. It's just tedious. And that's where we should probably end, because I've got 5 minutes to run over to the VC and introduce myself to the choir. This is a large area. I hope what we've done is what Holden does best, which is have conversation. I hope this hasn't been a lecture. I've enjoyed the back and forth. But this is a huge subject that we could spend tons and tons and tons of time with. But if you've got issues in your church where you've got your own worship war going on and you'd like maybe some insight into, okay, what's going on here and can we solve this, talk to me. Maybe I can help flesh out a dynamic of what's going on and offer some help. Or at least be a pair of ears.
Thank you. Thank you.